Welcome to another in our series of Kehillat Israel podcasts. This is a recording of Rabbi Amy Bernstein's weekly Friday morning Torah study.
We are beginning our study of the book of Vayikra for this year, the book of Leviticus. Shockingly, not everybody's favorite book of Torah, but I love Leviticus. So Leviticus grows on me as I started to last class with, because in some way of the biblical theologies, because there are many, the Bible is put together over a period of about 1,000 years. So the evolution of thought from the earliest text and our earliest foundation mythology, the evolution from there to the canon, you know, the end of the canon, there's a lot of evolution in theologies and a lot of different schools of thought within biblical theology itself. And so the book of Leviticus for me is one of, as I said last time, is its theology actually lines up a little better with, a lot better for me than other biblical theologies do. In that, God is understood by the P author, the priestly author, which is most of the book of Leviticus, other than the holiness code. The P author really understands God as a force. And then the way we deal with that force is necessarily careful. And we're to pay close attention to the ways that it's appropriate and not appropriate to engage with that force. So we are the ways that Leviticus understands, the priestly author understands, we draw close to God and draw God close to us, meaning close to the community, is one of them is through the sacrificial system. So sacrifice was common in the ancient Near East. It's, I would say, almost universal. So it was the technology for relating to the gods in all the surrounding cultures and in ancient Israel as well. The anthropology world wants to talk about sacrifice sometimes as possibly, for society, a channeling of aggressive instincts. So rather than there being random acts of violence, all of that aggression is transferred onto the victim of the slaughter of sacrifice, that the blood, the instinct for blood, is there in rites and rituals that use animal blood. However we want to talk about why we think it developed, why it hung around, we can have our, obviously, our theories. So no one's going to come and say, oh yeah, that's right. So we can have our theories, and most of us have a distaste for the idea of sacrifice. However, if one only ate sacral meat, then it meant the only meat that could be eaten, which means the only animals that could be killed, happened within this system. And so if you go into a grocery store and head towards the back of the store and walk along that back refrigerated wall, there is a whole bunch of dead animal back there. We do not blink. We do not think about it. We do not, whether you eat meat or don't, we accept how much dead animal is in every single grocery store you walk into, knowing how much of that meat will be thrown away, either because it goes bad in the store or because, I don't know about y'all, but I have been guilty of buying meat and life happens. And I don't cook it in time. I forgot to freeze it. And now it goes right in the garbage. That would have been shocking to the biblical author. Shocking and horrified, right? They would be horrified by taking the life of an animal to end for no purpose. They would be horrified by industrial meat houses. What do you call those? Slaughterhouses. They would be horrified by industrial chicken farming. They would be horrified for the quality of life or lack thereof for the animals, that it is not natural, that it is torturous to animals to raise them the way we do. Think about veal. Think about what happens with baby cows that are locked in a pen for a year or whatever. Like, they are taken from their mothers. They are locked in a pen. It just, on every level, the Levitical authors and consumers would have been horrified by our relationship to animal life and the taking of it. So I just like to put us in their shoes for a little bit. We who think we're so above animal sacrifice, like, ew. It's like, really? Ew? Right? So we just put it on styrofoam and wrap it in plastic, and somehow that's better because we weren't there for the killing of the animal. But we are participating. I eat meat. I include myself. We are participating in the cruel treatment and really cruel ways of killing animals, because we want to eat meat. In their system, that was not possible. All meat was sacrifice. So you ate with the community. That there was no freezers. So once you killed an animal, you had to eat it. So some of it was given to the priests. Some of it, depending on the offering, some of it was eaten by the offerer of the sacrifice. But it was a communal meal because that whole animal needed to be eaten. So you were feeding your clan. You were feeding your neighbors. This was understood to be lunch, dinner with God. So you bring the sacrifice. God comes and partakes. The priest partake, God partakes, and your clan partakes. It was very much a communal experience, which is very different from driving by the window in In-N-Out Burger, right, and getting your meat served to you in a bag as you eat it alone in your car, rushing to the next thing you have to get done, right? So that is a very different relationship to the consumption of animal flesh than the Levitical and the biblical author would have had.
I grew up in a slaughterhouse town in Texas. Armour and Swift were there. One of the biggest organizations was 4-H. And one of the purposes of 4-H was not only to teach about farming and ranching, but to teach children that the animals that they raised and even became attached to were meat, and not to get attached to the animals because they're not pets. It was very hard for kids.
So it's part of life for some kids.
That's right.
It's just part of life. And in the Levitical system, it was part of life. It was understood. Animals are raised to be eaten.
Well, excuse me. I'm a 4-H'er, and that's not the purpose of 4-H, but thanks for bringing it up.
It was one of the...
And she's saying in her town it was. Victoria, Judith is...
No,
saying,
I yes. got... And
that's what happened.
And that is her opinion of what happened. My opinion is otherwise, and I do not ever hold that that was the purpose of 4-H. I'm a generational 4-H'er and leader here in Los Angeles. So anyway, thank
right.
you.
We now have our opinions on 4-H. So we can have a discussion about it later. Each of you will have to pull your sources and see Probably. How the 18 decides. Okay. So we're going to start at, oh, look, we have two kids into our study this morning. Makes me very happy. Raven's kid, Daphne's kid. Love that. Start him young. All right. Let's go to.
I was just wondering if the theological system, referring to naked cow, really the psychological patient. Both of the attachment and the animism.
About takes into account the psychological.
Very profound psychological implication. General state of psych. Well, because it's both it's a very strong attachment. It's clearly an animistic.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm sure anthropologists go crazy, right, with that, right? That. Of course, there's some reason it remained powerful. There's some reason it was the system because it clearly served right? Some kind of deep.
Mm-hmm. Is it reflected in the theology?
It is not reflected in Israelite theology, because Israelite theology moves away from the idea that God needs food. Probably they're in kapara, in the serving of the need for expiation. There is some of the transfer of the victim status from the person who deserves it to an animal. So that is a little bit there in the theology, that you put your hands on the head of the animal, it now stands in for you and is slaughtered in your place. But the difference of other sacrificial systems and their relationship to theology is that you're feeding the gods. And Israelite theology moved away from that. What God gets from the sacrifices is the reach nichoach. God gets the pleasing odor of fat, which is one of my favorite smells. I mean, think about it. A grill, when somebody's barbecuing, like I can smell it from, right, miles away. It's one of the greatest smells. So that they understood that that's what God got. So you still have a God that smells, but you don't have a God that eats. All right. So let's go to the beginning of Tzav. We're going to Leviticus chapter 6, the beginning of our parsha. Something new and different. Vayidaber Adonai al Moshe l'amor. God speaks to Moshe saying, Tzav et Aharon ve'et banav l'amor. Command Aaron and his sons, saying, Zot Torat Ha'ola. This is the Torah of Ola, of the Holocaust. Hi Ha'ola al Mokda. It is the Ola, that literally that which goes up, meaning it is the whole thing is consumed, right? In that offering, the Ola offering, all of the offering is consumed. Al Mokda, on its fire. Literally on her fire. That's what that hay is doing at the end of Mokda. Al hamizbeach kol halayla. On the altar, on the fire, on the altar, all night, ad haboker, until morning. Ve'esh hamizbeach tukadbo, and the fire of the altar, tukadbo, is to keep going on it. And the priest will dress in linen raiment with linen breeches next to his body. And he shall take up the ashes to which the fire has reduced the burnt offering on the altar and place them beside the altar. So the dross is going to build up, and it is the priest's job to come every morning and clean with a shovel, you know, clean those off. Because they've been part of a sacred sacrifice, they are collected beside the altar. He shall then take off his vestments and put on other vestments and carry the ashes outside the camp to a pure place. So when the ashes build up to a certain point, now you have to empty it. But it's not just dumped. It is taken out to a makom tahor, to a pure place, because again, it has been part of the sacrificial system. And the fire on the altar shall be kept burning, lo tichbe, not to go out. Uvier aleha, and it will be every morning fed by the kohen, by the priest, itzim, with right trees, with wood. Every morning, baboker baboker, like every morning, and turning on it into smoke the fat parts of the shlamim offering. And now in verse 6, what looks like department of redundancy department, God forbid, Eish tamid tukar al mizbeach lo tichbe. A fire shall be kept burning regularly on the altar, not to go out. All right, so we are getting very clear instructions here about this fire on the altar not going out. That the priest, and there's all this discussion in the Talmud about they had three stacks of wood ready, because it is made very clear it cannot go out. That means you have to have wood ready at hand always to feed the fire on the Mizbeach. Now, an interesting question comes up. If the Mishkan is a traveling sanctuary, what's the problem? What's my
going to keep the fire going?
How are you going to keep the fire burning? So this is a question. How do you keep the fire burning? And if we're going to use tamid as always and not regularly, where else is that word used about fire? Tamid?
Near tamid?
Where is that?
Tamid.
In the eternal flame?
In the sanctuary.
The menorah. The menorah is to be lit tamid in the Mishkan. We've translated it, if you've been learning with me, we translate it as regularly, because it happens every morning. It doesn't mean always. That is a not necessarily correct translation. But if we're going to say the Esh Tamid on this altar means always, then some people want to say, then you have to translate it the same way for the menorah. That has to mean always. But then what do you do with traveling? You're going to be traveling. How can there possibly be constantly a flame going on the Mizbeach, on the altar? And how can there possibly be a flame going on the menorah? That doesn't make any sense. So, of course, for some of our rabbis, there was a miracle that happened. And whenever they would break camp, a tiny bit of the altar coal was still hot enough to be considered
on fire.
And one little wick of the menorah stayed aglow. And this was the miracle of the Mishkan, that there was Esh Tamid on the altar and on the menorah. Okay. So, but in any case, scholars are left with, well, that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. What about when nobody was bringing a sacrifice? If nobody's bringing a sacrifice right now, then why do you have a fire going on the altar? What's up with that? Right. So lots and lots of questions, right, to be raised by our Parsha. A few.
Well, it's unusual that the rules for the priest, among religions at that time, the rules for the priest were public.
Yes. We've talked about that. That this is different from other cult systems, in that the behavior of the priests of the cult would have been secret. Only the priests.
And they can be held to account by the public.
If it's public.
Since the public knows what the rules are.
Correct. But, of course, the public can't see what they're doing. Because they can't be in the Mishkan.
That small fire is symbolic of devotion.
And Sarah Moskowitz leaps ahead to where I have written devotion as fire. So, yes, once again, Sarah's ahead of us. So, right. So as I told you last session, the rabbis always are looking to keep Torah relevant. So either you have to throw this out with the destruction of the second temple because there's no sacrifice. So either you excise all of this material, or what can you do with it?
Reconstruct.
You can reconstruct it. Thank you, Bert.
You walk right in.
I'd walk right in. We can reconstruct it and have a relationship to it that is symbolic and no less meaningful in moving it from actual instructions and imagining it being the practice, moving from that to it being a metaphor. And the rabbis are very successful in making that transition from actual sacrifice in the cultic system to prayer as the new technology, and they move all of this stuff into their understanding of prayer and avodah, sacred service in general. So other mitzvot, prayer and other mitzvot. They move this very easily on, they map it onto both that and the fact that our table is now an altar. So if prayer is the new technology, what is the altar?
Platform.
Huh?
Platform.
What is the platform? If we're moving from the altar because we're not doing sacrifice, we're now using prayer as our technology. What is the altar?
Heart.
The heart. The heart.
And they become the fires of the heart.
So now we got to deal with fire. Mm-hmm. If the altar is the heart, then fire is going to get translated, you know, in as metaphor for lots of different things. Okay, so we're going to look at a few examples of that. So notice that what does it talk about when it talks about the olah in verse 2? The instruction is called Torah. This is Torat ha'olah, the Torah of the Holocaust.
What does Holocaust mean in this context?
The olah.
The
olah, the sacrifice is this.
There's the hate sacrifice, long sacrifice. There's a lot of sacrifices.
Right. The olah is the Holocaust, is the one that's burned up completely. So this is Torat ha'olah. This is the Torah of the olah sacrifice. It's to be burning on the altar all night long. Right. And then we get mentioning, by the way, the fire on the altar has to be burning all night long, regardless of whether or not there's an olah on it, right? It's to be tamid, lo tuka, you will not, lo tichbe, not to be put out, okay? So then we get verse 7, vizot Torah tamincha, and this is the Torah of the mincha offering. Hakrevota, when you bring it close. Who? Bnei Aaron, the sons of Aaron, lifnei yudhei vavhei, before God, al pnei ha-mizbeach, in the face of, meaning literally in front of the mizbeach, in front of the altar. And you will take and lift up of it a handful of the flour, and oil of the meal offering shall be taken from it, with all the frankincense that is on the meal offering, and this token portion shall be turned into smoke on the altar as a pleasing odor to Yod-Heh Vav-Heh. So this is what's known, if you make challah, as taking challah. Anyone who makes challah takes a portion of it and throws it into the fire. That's taking challah, comes from here. That a portion of it is given over, right, to God, in this case, as a pleasing odor, presumably because of the frankincense. What is left shall be eaten by Aaron and his sons. It shall be eaten as unleavened cakes in the sacred precinct. They shall eat it in the enclosure of the tent of meeting. So this is a sacral meal. Because it's been part of an offering, it is now a sacral meal. And part of the cult practice is to dine in the presence of the divine who has come to enjoy the reach nicholach of the offering. It is very important to the rabbis that at the end of Leviticus 9, chapter 9, verse 24 of Leviticus says that when all of the, and we studied this last year, specifically we studied this last year, that remember there was all, we had this study of the anxiety of would God accept and would God move in? That they built the house, but would God move in? And there was all this anxiety. And that what happens is a fire goes forth from God and consumes, right, what's on the altar. So the altar is ablaze with a fire from God. That's what lights the altar. And the priest has to feed it every morning. So for the rabbis, it is very important that there's fire from God on the altar. And fire has to come from human beings every day. That winds up being very important to the Hasidic masters and other folks who used this as spiritual metaphor.
Are they separate fires or one fire?
Well, you get to pick your side on that.
Well, I think it's interesting when you're talking about this because it brings back memories of my childhood. And I remember going into the temple at night when it was by myself, when it was dark, and seeing that light. and it somehow was meaningful to me. And when you're talking about that, all these memories
come flooding in
back. Yeah.
And that, in that sense, the mistranslation of tamid, ner tamid, being constant rather than regular, in that sense, the mistranslation led to a practice that's become deeply meaningful to Jews, right? And I think a lot of people feel that way, that when you come in the dark at night and you see the ner tamid lit, there is some way that that communicates still to us a sense of hope, a sense of we're not alone, a sense of, right, there's something constant.
Still there.
And it's still here. And, right, so there, it works, right, as symbol, as metaphor, it seems to work. And it has become deeply important language to the tradition, this language of the altar, this language of the fire, this language of offering, this language of drawing close. All of that language really works, because if we are taking prayer seriously, and you can have prayer be meditation, you can have prayer be walking in nature, you can have prayer be silence, you can have prayer be chant or song, whatever, however you think of prayer, right? The intention of drawing close to the divine, however we understand that in our lives, whether you want to think of it as within, without, both, that language of korban, sacrifice, which we don't have a Hebrew word for other than the technology by which we draw close. We draw the divine close, and we draw close to the divine. That language works for prayer, because that's what one is doing when one intentionally enters a state that we would call prayer. We are looking to draw close. We are looking to be in relationship. Sarah.
But it's followed by a troubling line.
Uh-oh. Is there a troubling line in Torah?
Only the males among Aaron's descendants.
Yes, only males could be priests. Only men.
Why do you think that is?
Why do we think that is?
There's a patriarchal society. If it were patriarchal, it would be only women.
Women are busy with the children.
Women are busy with the children in traditional societies. And you have to remember that early Israel is moving from goddess worship and priestesses in the ancient Near East to the worship of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh exclusively, the male god exclusively, which means you have got to get rid of all implications that there is a goddess, and her priestesses has to be gotten rid of. If you're going to have normative patriarchy to the male god, you his technicians have to be male. Everybody understands that. Go read an anthropology text. Everyone understands that if you're moving to patriarchy, from matriarchy, you have got to have the most important people, the functionaries, have to be men.
Not just in Judaism.
No, of course not. In any patriarchy, the people with the highest status are male.
That's what patriarchy means.
That's what patriarchy means. That is the definition. That's why. In matriarchal cultures, it was not needed to have women have higher status than men. We know this from the great anthropological work, The Chalice and the Blade. In The Chalice and the Blade, she argues in matriarchal, matrilineal, matrilocal cultures, men and women had equal status. Women did not need to make men subservient or less than, not so in patriarchy. So it just is what it is.
I refer to it the good old days.
And we, Sarah, that's why we have liberal Judaism, right? It's because we reject inherently that notion. However, one of our scholars, Dr. Tamar Kamienkowski, she argues that essentially, if you read carefully what we just read, what's happening is sacred housekeeping. What's happening is
housewife.
Housekeeping. Exactly.
The priest is basically the God's housewife.
So the priests are in dresses. They're in beautiful, woven, carefully designed dresses, tending the hearth, tending the fire that is generally understood to be the center of the home. And it is identified with women. So that the priests, according to Kami Jankowski and others, and it's here in your Women's Torah commentary, the priests are God's housewives. They're cooking, right? The fire is now the fire of the altar, but he's cleaning. Mm-hmm. He's sweeping. He's getting rid of the ashes. They're carrying out the ashes, right? Then you've got to get the wood and you have to tend the fire. This was women's work. And now it is understood to be the highest status is doing that for God. And your technicians are male. But they are doing work that is associated, right, traditionally with women.
Because it's for God.
Well,
what?
They're doing it because it's for God.
Yeah.
Which keeps the women still doing the other work and not bringing.
No, of course. Of course. That's what we're talking about. In a patriarchal society, the highest positions of respect and power are going to be given to men.
Yes. It becomes holy work.
Of course. Duh. Right? Duh. So, I mean, I don't mean to be smart. I'm just saying we know this. This is universal truth. When you have cooking, it's done by women. When it's a high paid, sexy profession, it's chef.
Right.
And who is it?
Sam.
Men. Okay, so the minute you're looking at patriarchy and you're looking at positions of status, they are by definition male.
No, I don't want to contradict any of that. Cause I think that's
awesome. Good.
There's another much more fundamental reason, and that is that the male, the father, is the third object. So that the child can come out of the symbiosis with mother. And the societies follow their own societies necessarily follow the same path. There, if the third object is not invested in that way, father or the male is not invested in that way, child remains in a symbiosis with mother.
Right, but I don't want to argue for one second that matrilineal and matrilocal cultures were somehow less healthy and developed because they didn't invest the male.
No, they're not.
With that kind of.
They're not. They're in no way so. But that development is essential.
Right, but it's not necessary, emphasis on the wrong syllable. It is not necessary that you have to have patriarchy as a result. Matrilineal, matrilocal cultures that had the goddess as the creatrix also had that kind of human development. Patriarchy is not necessary to that process is what I'm arguing. I understand that you're saying maybe it's related, but it's not necessary. It's a move that happens. It's not necessary, right? Unless you've got some men who are nervous about that attachment mm-hmm. and about to whom the baby belongs. And then you have, now it's going to transfer to the male, right? Because we know who mom is, right? We know who the mother is. We don't know necessarily who the father is, which in matrilineal, matrilocal cultures didn't matter. The father didn't matter. You took a new father every 3 to 4 years. Whoever was on the rise, like whoever was strong, whoever could protect you and your offspring, you had a new father every time you had a kid. Because the father didn't matter. Mattered as part of the community, but really didn't matter to the nuclear family, which was mom, her aunts, and female relatives, and female children.
That sounds good.
Because the males would marry and move to the woman's family. That's what matrilocal means. I'm just telling you all how it is. I do not make this stuff up. I simply report.
There's something interesting happening, though, because the female principle or the female influence, this vestige of it, still creeps in. And I want to be like, in Christianity, you have Mary. She's pretty important, even though they try to downplay. Like, we have this shit. What that's still, I mean, who's pushing that? Is it the women or?
It's very interesting. If you look at the archaeological record, I've said it before, but I want to say it in this context because some people don't listen to every podcast. In this context, if you, I know, right? Shocking, but true. If you look at the archaeological record, every single period of Israelite occupation of homes and material culture shows worship of Asherah or Astarte. As I've said in Kuntilada Druid, we have the, in the south, we have an inscription to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh and his Asherah.
Oh, that's interesting.
So we don't know, but it doesn't seem to be just the women, right? It's in Israelite households. And so it's hard to believe males had nothing to say about that and or wouldn't have partaked in that ritual, right? So it seems, yes, the instinct, the universal instinct for the divine feminine never goes away. And that is why, by the way, it's all over the prophets yelling and screaming about it, right? That we're whoring after other gods, right? The prophets don't have to yell and scream about something that's not happening. You don't have to yell and scream at the Jews about trees in their living rooms in December if it's not happening, right? You don't yell about a Hanukkah bush if nobody's doing it. It wouldn't make any sense, right? So the fact that we get this all over the prophets, it's happening everywhere in Israel. And rabbinic Judaism moves to Shekhinah as the divine feminine, for sure, for sure. And she, of course, is less. When you look at the Kabbalistic system, she's the lowest sphira, right? Shekhinah is associated with Malchut, the lowest sphira that is the sphira that is closest to our earthly physical existence, right? Keter is the highest. And of course,
something divine.
Huh?
Make something divine in Judaism.
I don't know how to answer that question.
I'm not sure what it means.
I don't know what that means. What makes something divine?
When you talked about the divine presence of the Shekhinah, what makes that divine?
It's of God.
It just means of God.
Yeah.
But then all of us are divine in a way, too.
Of course.
That's what we're supposed to be.
Of course. That doesn't mean we're God.
No, but we're a part of.
Yeah, we're made in God's image.
Yes.
Okay. Can I go back to what you just read before?
I don't know, Mark. What would you like to go back
to? I was thinking about this mincha offering.
Yeah.
What does mincha mean?
Gift.
That's not the same as mincha prayers.
Right, service.
Yes. So every time there would have been sacrifices offered in the temple, the rabbis institute a prayer service.
Oh.
So sacrifices were offered in the morning. There was a mincha offering in the afternoon and a ma'ariv. There was an evening offering. And so every time, and there was an extra offering on holidays.
Musaf.
That's why we have musaf. So you have the regular morning service. If it's a holiday, you add musaf because there was an extra sacrifice. Then you have mincha and you have ma'ariv. But so that people shouldn't have to go to shul three times a day, you smash mincha into ma'ariv. So it's mincha ma'ariv. Like I grew up with mincha because we were already at school.
Yeah.
So we davened mincha at 3:15, right? But people who work, men who work, because women are not obligated to go to prayer three times a day, because any mitzvah related to time, women are exempt from. So only men are obligated to get to shul or to daven three times a day. And if they're working and they need to say Kaddish and they want to be with a minion, they can't leave work go to mincha, go back to work, then go for Ma'ariv. So you push mincha as late as you can, halachically, and you start Ma'ariv as early as you can, and it's mincha Ma'ariv. Yes. So they smush them together.
And the women are exempt because they have to be taking care of the children.
Women, it doesn't say why. Yes. Women are exempt from any commandment that is based on time. The presumption is because they can't, you can't say it's 3:15, put the toddler down.
Yeah.
And go, you know, say Adon Olam. You presumably you can't dictate to a woman what time she can do anything because she's got nine children.
She's breastfeeding.
She can't go to mincha, right?
Making her husband dinner.
She's making dinner. Right. She has a lot to do. So presumably that's why they are not bound by mitzvot having to do with time. Okay.
I have a question about that musaf.
Yes.
Does that come from the word osef, like addition?
Yes. Lehosif, to add, to gather, to add. Yes.
This is as interesting as the story itself, the customs and how they've maintained.
Thank God. Okay. Lee is saying, I wonder if that development feels necessary, meaning patriarchy, because patriarchy has been one, the big civilizing, heavy scare quotes here, forces in human history, which isn't necessarily right or best. It's just what happened. Okay. So let's go to what the rabbis did with some of these texts. And I'm just bringing you a sample. It is not even a representative sample, but we'd be here all day, which maybe that is the next thing I teach is a course where we go into more detail. I'm just bringing you a little taste of what the rabbis do with this. So we're going to look at from an article by Admiel Kosman. And if you don't know in what country Admiel is born, right? It's like, I was like, okay, clearly an Israeli. Fire as symbol, a brief overview of a burning topic. See what he did there? All right. Several cultures have created myths about fire, wherein fire creates an axis between nature and culture. In short, at one end, fire is a chaotic and intimidating natural power. Any of us who live in Southern California know this really seriously. We know it really well, right? You see that smoke and everybody knows what can happen, right? And so it's chaotic and intimidating as a natural power. And at the other end of the axis, fire is the supplier of warmth and intimate pleasure. So think, like we were talking about, this is where Kosman was talking about the hearth and how that fire is tended by women. And then it moves to, right, okay. Oh, here we look. Most religions adopted the feminine domestic symbol of the fire burning in the hearth and applied it to the public house, right? The house that's associated with the public space, namely the local temple. In the temple, handling of the fire was transferred to the ritual sphere and priests, men too, of course, were entrusted with its preservation. A new identity was created over the course of human history between fire and the presence of the god. Fire signified the god's presence in the sanctuary, which had been built in his name. Its extinguishing was considered a portent of disaster, a sign that the community had fallen into disfavor in the eyes of the god, and he would no longer watch over it, leaving it exposed to the hammer blows of destiny. In the Bible, too, the temple priests were enjoined to preserve the eternal flame, which had originally come from heaven during the inauguration of the temple. As I told you, Leviticus 9:24, it had to be kept, never to go out, as in most temples around the world. So what I love about this is it's putting it into this text we just read into context. Every religious tradition in the neighborhood would have had an understanding that what we count on in the home to keep us warm, to provide light, that people cooked over, right? That same fire now moves into the public house, which is the house of the god. And the fire symbolizes the presence of the god. Well, then it makes sense. If the fire symbolizes the presence of the god, what you're not going to do is put it out, right? So not only are you not going to put it out, you won't let it go out. So you're going to be vigilant about tending that fire, okay? So this would have been, it just kind of understood, if the fire is the presence of the god, this text makes total sense. Then you're going to be sure that fire doesn't go out, right? Because it means otherwise, disaster.
Didn't we just see at the end of Exodus that there was a God was going to be a fire that led the Jewish people?
So that's the pillar of fire.
But it's fire as well.
Correct. So fire as the presence of the God is not unusual at all. Okay. So, but the other thing that our tradition does in moving from sacrifice to all of these things being metaphor is that now we talked about the Mizbeach. We talked about the altar being the heart. Then you have to ask, what's the fire? Right. And Sarah already jumped ahead. But before we get to Sarah's interpretation, which is all over the rabbinic tradition, we're going to look at another interpretation of fire. And that is, fire is, of course, Torah. Fire is Torah. What are some of our associations with Torah and fire?
Burning bush.
Burning bush. Good. Biblically. Burning bush. What else? It's a big mountain.
Right. Sinai.
Sinai.
Plano erupted.
Sinai is a smoke. It's a flame. The presence of the God is represented by fire. So both at the sneh, at the bush, when Moshe's first talking to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and figures, and is trying to figure out who this divine being is, and when God reveals God's self to the people on Sinai, fire. So it makes complete sense. Torah, when we're talking about fire, the fire on the altar, the fire, of course, is fire. Right. So let's look at Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak of Lubavitch on how and why Torah is compared to fire. In what ways? A, fire consumes and annihilates. So it is with Torah. Torah annihilates the evil, the ra, in one's heart. Mm-hmm. Okay. And remember, this is not just Torah, the text. It's living, how you live Torah, how you practice Torah, is how we deal with our selfish, horrible, arrogant, greedy, lustful selves, tendencies. That's what Torah's for. That's why God didn't give it to the angels, right? When the angels say, how can you give Torah to those beasts, those apes? God says, what, do you steal? Do you smack each other in the head? No. So why do you need Torah? They need Torah, right? So that's what Torah's for. So there's that. B, fire sheds light and warmth on its surroundings, and Torah sheds light and warmth, right, on everything it surrounds. C, when fire burns in one place, it may suddenly flare up in another, as we know living here, especially if there's a bit of
wind.
All right, now give me the Hebrew word. Ha. Especially if there's ruach. Wind. What else is ruach in Hebrew?
Spirit.
So when Torah is studied and observed by one individual or community, it catches on in others, especially if there is a whiff of its inner spirit blown around.
Contagious.
It carries the ability to ignite what is just a tiny little spark. Fire generates fear. Well, similarly, Torah should generate Yirat Shamayim, awe of heaven, right? A sense of the bigness, the hugeness of all of it. And fire reveals the truth that the physical reality is of no substance. See, it says how quickly all is gone, right? We think our homes are so safe and wonderful because we have the greatest new alarm system ever. So we are completely safe, and all of our stuff that we spend a lifetime accumulating is safe until it all burns down. right? And fire reveals in that sense how elusive or how delusional, right? This idea of how real and important and safe stuff is by burning it all up in an instant. Same with Torah. Torah reveals the truth that the material world is nothing. Godliness, holiness is the only true reality. Okay, this beautiful, here it's laid out explicitly, right? How and why it works that fire is a perfect, you taking that image of fire and using it to mean Torah works on all of these levels. Okay. But we also have devotion, as Sarah said so beautifully earlier, devotion as fire. And this is Rabbi Aaron Lieb Smokler commenting on the Sfat Emet, commenting on our verses. Every night, throughout the entire night, an animal would burn down to ashes on the altar, keeping the Mishkan aglow continuously. Even during the depths of nighttime darkness, there was always a little devotional light flickering, ensuring that that hallowed space never ceased to be a place of active worship. That's what we read. A fire burned incessantly on the altar, never extinguished. The constancy of burning devotion became, for Hasidic masters, an analogy for the human heart on fire with spiritual passion. The Baal Shem Tov himself and later his grandson, the Degel Machane Ephraim, articulated this aspiration clearly. And the fire of the altar shall burn with it. This means that in the heart of every person, a fire of enthusiasm should burn. On the altar continuously means all the time at every moment, right? So this is the Degel Machane Ephraim. Like the korbanot, sacrifices on top of the altar constantly aflame, a person should hunger feverishly, relentlessly for the divine. Her ardor must never be quelled and must never be quieted. All right. So for the Hasidic masters, this is not just, this is not just descriptive. It's prescriptive. Not just this is what happened, but be sure this is what happens, because you can state it both ways in Hebrew. The fire will never go out can mean don't, it's a negative commandment. Don't let the fire go out. So it's stated in the positive. It's to burn all night until morning. That's the positive. And it's also a negative commandment. Don't let it get put out. So for the Hasidic masters and for the spiritual traditions that come out of it, it's about the mitzvah of tending our own passion for connection with the divine. It's an active thing that one has to do. One has to tend the fire all the time, and one must be careful not to let it go out. It becomes a very real thing for them about how to feed that fire. And if you look at Mishnah Shkalim, so in the Mishnah, they said, what would they do with the leftover funds of the collection that had not been spent on communal offerings? So now this is the time of the temple. Remember, some people don't live close to the temple. They live in Babylonia. So, but you had to send money to the temple so the animals could be brought for sacrifice on your behalf. So you, what about when there was leftover money? Well, Rabbi Ishmael says the leftover produce was used to purchase the repletion of the altar, meaning burnt offerings sacrificed at times when the altar was idle. Rabbi Akiva says the leftover funds of the collection were used to purchase the animals used for the repletion of the altar, since they had originally been collected for offerings. Because that money was collected for sacrifice, you can't use it for anything else. But what are they really talking about? They're talking about this idea that there was always an offering on the altar. That when the altar was idle, they would take animals purchased with money that was left over and put that on the altar. Okay? Okay. So why did I bring this? Because the next scholar, she's going to use this Mishnah to show you exactly how the rabbis used all of this stuff to bring it into the metaphorical understanding of relationship with the divine. The Mishnah in Mishnah Shkalim explains that even when no one had any offerings to bring on the altar, it was necessary to offer sacrifices continuously from the leftovers of the public funds contributed to the temple. Perhaps the continually burning flame on the altar then, if that's true, was a sign of the devotional impulse. Even when there was no need to offer a particular sacrifice, sacrifices were nonetheless offered as a sign of our eternal readiness and commitment to give of ourselves and to draw close to God. In the absence of a temple, how do we keep these lights aflame? So, right? How does this work for us as metaphor that actually talks about spiritual practice? There are many ways of keeping our inner altar burning, and what works for one person may not work for another. Some people may find that daily prayer, even on days when we have nothing in particular to say to God, ensures that this channel of communication remains open so that when we do need to talk to God, we have a language with which to do so. For others, a practice of regular study, daf yomi, meaning a page a day, or the weekly parsha, for some of us, is a way of remaining in touch with something beyond and greater than ourselves, which is tending that flame. Still, others may feel that a regular commitment to helping those in need, delivering food baskets, visiting an old age home, making phone calls to the homebound, ensures that the impulse to give and sacrifice of ourselves remains healthy and strong within us. We cannot always wait for the devotional impulse to well up inside us. In my own life, I've gone through periods when I felt so depleted that any spiritual flame is dimmed within me. I've learned that if I establish routines, perpetual flames in my more hopeful moments, then these practices will carry me through the difficult times. Sometimes it can feel as if I'm merely going through the motions, my brain and body on autopilot, but inevitably at some point, after a few days or a few weeks or perhaps even longer, the fire will burn more brightly inside me. Our Partha teaches us that in those moments when we don't feel we have anything to offer, we offer nonetheless. We take from the leftover funds, the habits and disciplines we've already cultivated, because they enable us to keep the fire burning. If we are fortunate, the sacrifices that come merely from the leftover funds inside us will eventually combust into an offering of wholeness, the shlamim, and we will recognize that the light of the divine presence continues to burn within us.
Amen.
Amen, they say. Right? So these are just a few examples of how the tradition continues. I mean, this is a contemporary reflection on a Mishnah that seems to have nothing to say to us. Talking about the leftover funds and this and that. And okay, so they put it in and it looks like, okay, well, what are you going to do with that? It doesn't really say much. But you see what she did with it, right? It becomes a whole teaching. If you take it seriously as metaphor, it works. What do leftover funds here mean? It means the stuff that got built up when I was feeling connected to prayer, right? Because I just do it, or I was doing meditation regularly, right? Then there's something left over from that. And we can draw on the leftovers when we feel completely tapped out, right? That there's no fire, then we can trust the leftovers. But to have leftovers, what do you have to do first?
You've been listening to Rabbi Amy Bernstein's Friday Morning Torah Study from Kehillat Israel in Pacific Palisades, California. For more information, go to our website, www.ourki.org.